Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Pat McDade, and I am an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And my sobriety date is March 18th, 1988. And this is my home group, and I have a sponsor who's here, and I sponsor. Getting started is always the hard part, because for me it's what I want to say and then what God wants me to say, and I get caught in the middle, so bear with me. We already said the Serenity Prayer, right?
You can do it
anytime. Dear God, please help. The big book tells me I'm to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it is like today. So I will start and follow good direction on what it was like. I grew up in a small town in central New York State. It was kind of a happy days town, small town. We had the jukebox in the diner, and it was a great place to grow up. It was just one of those places that didn't really get touched by the outside world, in my mind. I was the fifth of six children. There was active alcoholism in my home. My dad was an alcoholic, and he died as a direct result at his own hand of alcoholism on a dry drunk, which why dry drunks terrify me, because I know the despair that people can go to when they're caught in that awful in-between place of sobriety and active drinking. My home, in sobriety, things are different than what I thought they were. And my whole perception has changed, which has been a great gift, because I wanted it to be okay. My disease went to the dark side all the time on everything. And it was a loving home. It was a good home. We wanted for nothing. We had everything we need. Now, that doesn't mean Santa Claus brought everything I wanted at Christmas, but our needs were met in a good way. For me personally, I do know that I always felt scared. There was an underlying fear within me, even though I was surrounded by a good family and a good home life and a good community life. And I don't know why it was there. Well, actually I do. Today I do. It then, I didn't know why it was there. And I spent a great deal of time from when I entered community, which is what, at 4, 5, 6 years old, trying to be okay. And I know I didn't know how to. And so I became the person that was right out there all the time. Before you came at me in a positive way. I mean, I was loud. I was the happiest in the room, and I was the cleverest in the room, and I had to be the est. Because I was terrified that you would find out that inside there wasn't anything. And, I've heard people, so much of what I'm going to tell you I heard in these rooms, and those were ahas. You know, you put so many phrases and words to my feelings. And I remember people saying when I came in the rooms, I didn't know. I thought I was supposed to know how to do it, how to be it, how to survive it. And, as my father's drinking progressed, I can remember I was like 9 years old when I became aware of what the problem was in our home. For both my parents, because my mother was reacting to my father's drinking. So we had that underlying tension, that anger, that life not going her way, too. And I remember I was going out into the kitchen, and we had a swinging door. It was a big old Victorian home, and we had a swinging door that went out into the kitchen. I had my hand on the door. I can remember the feel of it. And I heard my mother say, my dad's name was Al, if you pour another drink, I'm going to pour it down the sink. And clarity. That was the problem. Okay? And I came to know that his drinking was it. And for years, my brother and I would be down in the basement on Saturday morning looking in the rafters for the little gin bottles, I had a younger brother, 18 months younger, and we were more impacted by the disease. I had brothers and sisters on the other end that were 6 years older and up. And so my life started to change with that. And I will tell you today, I swore I would never have a house like that. I would never be like that. I would never drink like that. I never would. And unbeknownst to me, I have a disease of alcoholism that would run my life. And another gift when I came into these rooms was that you told me I had a disease, you know, because I had grown up thinking it was this good, bad thing. It was controllable if you just get your act together. Because that's what I heard people saying, you know, it's in the big book where they talk about, he's such a nice guy, you know, wouldn't you think? Or wouldn't he stop drinking for her? Or blah, blah, blah. So moving ahead, I went through high school. I was a good student. I had lots of friends. You know, all the outside was okay. And the inside was crashing. Because I the older I got and the more I was faced with, the less I could do. And I had my first drunk when I was 18. I grew up in New York State and it was legal to drink. I'm such a rule follower, which may have kept me alive to get here. I gotta tell you that. And I can remember it. It was at Tom Collins. And it was, we had just graduated from high school and we were celebrating and I was in a real bar with a real red checkered tablecloth and I had my Tom Collins and now I've arrived. I've grown up. I'm a woman now. And I remember drinking it and that first drink that does it. Down the hatch, down in the stomach, the fingers started going, you know, the toes felt better. It physically, I was already okay. All of a sudden, I can do this life thing. And that was the first lie alcohol told me, and it continued to tell me that till I was 43 years old. I went away to school for a little while. I found a job. I graduated from business school. And I'm going to take you through just a couple of my experiences because I really want to talk about recovery because I just love it so. When I was 19 years old, I went to a fall weekend at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And we were at the fraternity house, and that's where I was introduced to Johnny Walker Red Scotch, which was going to be my drink of choice when I could get it for a very long time. And this was a party, a 24-hour, three-day party. We were sloshing in scotch on the floor, as I remember it. I had a ball. I had an absolute ball, I think, because it was my first blackout. And I blacked out off and on through that whole weekend. And I didn't mind blacking out. That's where I wanted to go when I drank. You know, just take me out of here and take me over there, and whatever happens there, don't let me remember. You know, I mean, that's where I was. And I can remember riding the bus home back to Syracuse, which is where I was going to school, and my pores oozed scotch. I just know I stunk of scotch. And I got home, and I don't remember what happened there. I know I had a wonderful time. I must have, you know, because my alcoholism had already kicked in, and it told me this is what I wanted to do, and this is where I wanted to be. I married. I moved to Washington, D.C., got a job, found a hostage, married him, and he's here, you know. So now I'd like to look at it more of a partnership than a hostage, but it depends on what day it is, what's happening in our relationship. And I can remember I was at an after-hours party, and I walked into the doorway of this apartment where this after-hours party was in D.C., and I took one look at him, and he winked at me. That's it. That was it. Magic key, you know. And he had this great, you'll see, he has this great big, back then the Kennedys, John Kennedy had just died, and the Kennedys were in there. He had this great big toothy Kennedy smile, you know, and he was Irish, and he was Catholic, and he was a Navy pilot. And he was my Top Gun, Tom Cruise, you know, and he wasn't going to get away. That's all I know. Top it all off, he took me out. We left the party like at 5 o'clock in the morning. We're out in the parking lot, and the sun started to come up or whatever, and he's driving a Mercedes coupe, you know. All right, so he had all the credentials for a partner for life, all right. And I got him. Poor guy. He didn't know what hit him. He just, you know, over the years. So we married and started moving around with his job. He was out of the Navy and all, and we had four children, and who today are still part of our family by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I remember, because my daughter has babies now, and when I'm around her babies, I remember that. I didn't have to drink during those years. I mean, if we were going out, I'd have a drink, but it wasn't that in the back of the mind elixir of the God situation. And I, because this dark hole, this need I had, this terrible need I had, that I talked about right from the get-go, the fear and all, I could do babies. And I did it well. And they filled me. Those children, it just was, it was so wonderful. And they loved me unconditionally. I didn't have to be on for them. And, you know, this is such a thinking disease. It overwhelms me sometimes. And Bill, my husband, will say to me when we're having a conversation, I'm going, blah, 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 and he'll look at me and he'll go, why do you think like that? I come in here and you all go, I know just what you mean. Let me tell you about my experience, you know. And out there they're going, oh, Mom, you know. So anyway, and as the children grew and we continued to move, my drinking picked up. And I needed it again, is what happened. I had needed it early, and I needed it again, and it was there. And it all had to do with the wheels that kept turning in my head. You know, they talk about that committee in my head. You know, I had a full-blown board of directors room in there, and it was so scary for me because I really thought I was going nuts. And I kept getting busier and busier, and I'd wallpaper and I'd paint and make clothes. I did all these things that made me okay, you know, and that I could accomplish. And I'm feeling myself sinking into this mire of thinking. And I had to drink. I started to have to drink. And I was a sneak drinker. I had a bottle of scotch with a straw in it under the kitchen sink. You know, and I'd have this big, at the end, this big jug of that rock gut wine, that Gallo for $4 wine, you know, on the kitchen counter. And, you know, I'd be doing this, and then I'd be down here. I can remember holidays like Halloween, you know, Bill would go out with the kids trick-or-treating, and I'd be there to give out candy, like the good suburban housewife does these things. And all dressed up in a costume or some god-awful thing. And I'd have my drink of scotch, but the doorbell would ring, so I'd have to hide it. And so I'd like put it behind a picture frame or behind, and then I couldn't find it. Okay. So then I'd back in the kitchen, pour another drink, you know, get out there and be sipping away, doorbell rings, you know, so here a good suburban housewife doesn't come to the door with a bottle of scotch in her hand. So, you know, I hide it and I can't find it. For 2 or 3 days after Halloween, I would be finding these glasses with like this much scotch in it. Of course, I couldn't waste them. So I started drinking every day, you know, kind of thing. And that, you know, that the cycle of my life just took off. And I became that tornado running through the lives of those closest to me. I hid my drinking a whole lot from the outside world, but I created the home that I left behind. The tension, I would see my kids' eyes when they walked in from school, trying to figure out, okay, which mother is here? Are we going to have cookies and milk on the counter, you know, and, oh, kids, how was your day? Or are we going to have, damn it, you didn't make your bed again. Get up to your room. You know, the Jekyll, the Hyde? And I loved it when you told me about that because you gave me so many answers to questions I didn't know I had, you know, and I could see this, and it broke my heart. My broken heart over what was happening in my home eventually got me to these rooms because I had reached a point where I couldn't live with me. Let me get you to the end here. My mom came to live by us back in the early 80s, and she became ill, and I took great responsibility for her care and her subsequent death. And there's a part of me that thought, if I had done a better job of working with the doctors, being more, you know, because I had no power. Authority figures terrified me. You know, a nurse could run me down the hall crying if she said I was doing something wrong. You know, I can remember I went home from when she was, because she was in the hospital for a while, and they had to restrain her. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe these things were happening, and I couldn't do anything about it. This powerlessness over life and this terrible fear that I can't, who will, you know, kind of thing. And I can remember that they had restrained her and put an NG tube down. And, you know, that was like, for me, she was in a torture chamber. And I went home and went, got a bottle of scotch, and now I've got four kids, okay, two dogs, puppies, a husband who has become a workaholic because the house is a terrible place to come home to by 6 o'clock at night because I have gone to where I go, which is half drunk, half, you know, slurring my words, where have you been, why are you home so late, you know, all that kind of stuff and I, you know, isn't it, for me, there's this person out here watching this happen. And this person out here's heart is breaking because I have no power to change it. I have crossed that awful line into active, horrible alcoholism. So anyway, I can remember I grabbed a bottle of scotch and I went downstairs and I sat by the furnace. And it was a washroom furnace and I drank and I drank and I drank. And Bill opened the basement door and said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Finally." Because I had had enough that everything stopped. You know, I wasn't thinking. I zoned out. And I could breathe. I could breathe. My mom passed away, and that is when, although my drinking was alcoholic, when I drank, that is when I crossed the line into having no more choice. I was one of these people that would drink on weekends. I usually drank as much as I could where I could, depending on the circumstances. If we were going to one of my husband's business functions, I wouldn't drink because I knew once I started, I couldn't stop. But if we were partying with our friends or something, when I'm dressing, there's a big glass on the table. I'm going fortified. And we reached a point where I was no longer invited I was asked to leave. Bill, one time I can remember him taking me home from the party and he went back. And he told him I had the flu. Well, they all know I didn't have the flu. It's that proverbial flu that we get daily, you know. And so that's when my heart really started breaking when my mom passed away because it was like there's a pamphlet, an AA pamphlet that talks about the woman drinker, and they said that there are certain instances in their life where they will go over. You know, divorce, loss of a child, loss of a loved one, some big event where you're gone. And that's what happened to me. And from then on, if I wasn't drinking, I was planning the drink, I was hiding the drink, and, you know, I was recovering from the drink. And I was a 5 o'clock drinker. I had this rule that I didn't drink till 5 o'clock. And I loved it. One time my brother told me it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and that was very not bad to tell a person like me. And then I started drinking alone all the time. You know, the social drinking, if there really ever had been, because when I drank, I didn't care if you were there or not, even in the beginning, because the drink was what I was after. But I went into that lonely, awful place where we go. And I remember I would always have this little package of cheese and crackers like you put in a kid's lunch. And I always had it with me when I drank because ladies don't drink and not eat. Okay, I had to maintain. My disease told me so many lies, and one of them is if I was doing certain things, I wasn't that bad. Okay, so I carried around this cheese and crack, never to open it, but it was there, so it made me okay, you know, kind of thing. And I did a lot. That's when I was drinking alone. Bill would be gone a lot. This is when I had a island in our kitchen, and I would stand here like this with several drinks in me, and the kids would be there eating, and you know, my heart aches for them today because I know what it was like for them, because that's when I would start picking, you know, picking and complaining, whatever. And I would have the bottle there, and then I'd watch them leave. You know, they'd get out of there as fast as they could, and everybody went to their rooms to do what they needed to do. And I remember telling people, my kids don't sit around and watch TV or anything. They are so good. They go to their rooms and read, and they do their homework. And we have none of what you're complaining about goes on in your house, at, you know, at 7 o'clock at night, because Mike, da-da-da. Well, everybody was escaping the situation. My last drunk was on St. Patrick's Night in 1988. Bill and two of my sons he's from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and they were having this Loyal Sons of St. Patrick do. And he'd gone in for that with those two kids, and my two older children were at home, who were 18 and 16, or whatever, I can't remember. Two of them, my daughter and son were there. Anyway, I didn't know who was there, and I didn't care. St. Patrick's Day was really a big day for for me for years. It was, you know, New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, St. Patrick's Day, whatever. And I planned my St. Patrick's Day party. And I went out and bought my bottle of Johnny Walker Red Scotch, and I poured green food coloring in it. And here it is, a green bottle or whatever, brown bottle. And I colored it for St. Patrick's Day, and I got my tape of Danny Boy. Back then we were using tapes. And I put on my best drinking bathrobe, and I took my bottle and my cheese and crackers in the wrapper and my tape with Danny Boy, because my dad was a real maudlin drunk, and he would play Danny Boy. We had lost a brother during Vietnam. He crashed in the States when he was a pilot also. And so after that, Danny Boy became the theme for our family. And so I had my tape, and I went upstairs, and I had a candle and light, because I'm having a party, and this is elegant, okay? And I went upstairs to my bedroom, and I locked my bedroom door, and I had a walk-in closet. And I went in that closet, and I lit my candle, and I got my drink, and I put on my tape. And I remember it was a purple velour bathrobe. It was horrible. And, you know, but here I am. And I sat down, and I was going to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. And for the first time that I can remember, I couldn't get drunk. The wheels didn't stop. I couldn't get numb. And I'm in there, and by the grace of God or whatever, I did not burn down the house. I got a closet full of clothes with a lit candle in there. I could have passed out, and God knows what would have happened. But apparently God had a plan for me, because it didn't. And the phone rang, and it was my husband, and he was calling to say what a great evening they'd had, and the boys had done such a good job, and blah, blah, blah. And I, you know how when we're slurring our words, we go, oh, that's so wonderful, I'm so glad you called, kind of thing. And he said at the other end, I'll talk to you later, and he hung up. And that hit me so hard, because I'm sitting on the side of the bed, and I'm drunk. I just don't feel drunk, but I'm physically drunk. And I said that wonderful alcoholic prayer, dear God, I can't do this anymore, please help me. And I haven't had to pick up a drink since. That night, unbeknownst to me, God removed my obsession to drink. Now, I can tell you that for the next 2 weeks, I controlled my drinking by not drinking. But today, I know. I hadn't been able to do that for years. And that night, it was removed. I know for some people, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but that for me was the time. And I woke up the next morning. I did not know it was my last drink. Okay? God did. And I was looking for this inner healing thing. I knew I was a mess, and you know, I was still grieving my mother 3 years later. And that's what all the tears were about, because Bill kept saying, he remembered, I cried all the time. And I had such a soul sickness. And I was heading out for a retreat at St. Joe's Christian Life Center up on the lake in Cleveland. And I met a man there who was a recovering alcoholic. He was facilitating this weekend. And the weekend was, how about drama? Healing the heart within. I was all set for that. That was, you know, that's where they know my pain and they will take it away. And I arrived there with a 2-liter Pepsi bottle full of that rot gut wine I was telling you about, and my cheese and crackers, and I had gotten a private room because I could not drink, I thought, at that time. And so I had enough to get me through the first day, and I'd find an excuse to leave. And I got out of the car, and the snow is covering the ground, it's March up there. And I got out of the car, and I reached in the trunk, and it was in a brown paper bag, you know, so I'd gone that far down. I had my wino brown paper bag. And inside, I said, I can't do this here. This is holy ground. And I poured out the wine, the red wine on the white snow. And it was very symbolic to me that my life and soul had been saved. And that was so hard, because all of a sudden I knew that I had lost my best friend and my worst enemy, but it had protected me from myself for so many years. And I walked into that retreat house, I felt bare naked. you know, I had no defense against life walking in there. And my God, my high power, presented me with the first recovering alcoholic I had ever known. And he told me there was a way out. And he told me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to him, but you don't understand. I am a woman alcoholic, the lowest of the lows. And he said, I think you'll find a few there. And that began my journey into recovery. And therein lies the love story. I walked into a woman's meeting. I stayed sober for a week. And then on my own, supposedly, in my mind. And see, I'm okay. And I had this nudge in the back of my head to get to these meetings. I knew I needed something. And I walked into my first AA meeting. And it was like three stories up in a church. And I was walking in the room up the stairs. And I heard laughter. And I heard chit-chat. And I heard some children. And I thought, I got to be in the wrong place because I'm supposed to go in where everybody's like this. Oh, you know, poor me. I can't drink and life is so bad and all. And I walked into that room and there were all these women there and they were clean and nobody had on an old raincoat. And, you know, and I sat down and I whispered to the woman next to me that this is my first meeting. You know, and the shame, the guilt, and the remorse that I took to that table in that meeting and over the years have been able to leave there was so overwhelming for me at that time. I thought, oh my God, I told somebody, okay, beyond the man that I had met at the retreat. And she jumps up and she said, we got a new one, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, and I'm going, oh Lordy, you know, because I just, how do you get out under the table and out the door with nobody looking? And she, and then It began. They told me things. I can't remember what they said, but I remember identifying from the first word that came out of their mouths. And I brought to you my problem, and you gave to me my solution. And I don't remember hearing about God or higher power. I didn't have any problem with God when I got in here. He just was a God in a box. You know how we get a doc in the box, you go in for a quick fix and then you leave. You know, you go into CVS and you get your minute clinic. Okay, so God was my minute clinic. And I had put this big, I had limited my God. You know, he wasn't part of that. He was part of big things and part of taking care of my children or whatever. But for me, you know, I don't know if I didn't think I was worried. I don't know any of that. I just know that I wasn't looking toward him. And so they gentled me into that. And I, two women took me aside, and they took me to meetings for 2 weeks. And then they said, okay, now you're on your own. You know, you've met people, you know what to do, you know where to go. And that's what I did, and that's what I've been doing for the last 20-plus years. And it has never, ever failed me, ever, that I have walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and I haven't left better for it. Even if I've come in and just developed a lot of tolerance for the way it's being done, I'm better for having developed some tolerance. And I came to discover the journey of life. I came to know that it's okay, I don't know, because you do. You know. I can bring to you on an individual basis or sometimes in a comment what's going on inside of me. I can share down to my soul, which now is not as sick. You know? You told me it's a thinking disease. I am not a bad person trying to get good. I am a sick person trying to get well. I clung to the fact it was a disease because then I can handle that, okay? But this badness that I felt, this emptiness that I had felt for so many years, I can't handle that. But if I have a disease and you can help me get better and put it into remission, I'm all for it. Everybody hits a different bottom. I lost nothing. I lost everything. Inside, I lost everything. Outside, everything looked, you know, I had everything in order, and it wasn't working anymore. When I discovered that it was my inside job and an inside problem, that's when I knew that I couldn't do it myself. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it has led me to a God of my understanding. And a God that I now believe understands me. I got a sponsor, and well, a sponsor got me. I had gotten this. This is Beth. I had I had found a sponsor who met all my needs. She didn't ask me any questions. We drank coffee and talked about chit-chat the whole bit. Well, eventually she went out. About a year and a half later, she left AA. And then I was sitting at a meeting, and there was this little redhead woman who seemed to run the world. And, you know, she was just all over everything and doing everything and had an opinion on everything. And she was a tough old bird, and I used to watch her, and I thought, oh, my God, she terrified me. And I was sitting there, and I just leaned over to her at the table, and I said, what do you do if your sponsor doesn't go to meetings? And she handed me her phone number, and she said, I will be your sponsor. You know, she didn't wait for me to come up and ask her anything. She stepped right in. And the way I was taught to do AA, I learned from that woman. And Beth was my sponsor for 18 years. And she taught me how to be in relationship with God and my fellow man. She taught me to do the grunt work of each day, staying sober. I don't ever remember her taking me to the high places. It was one foot in front of the other for years, just for years. And, you know, we would talk about a higher power. We would talk about God, but she taught, I didn't know how to be with you. Not, you know, a people in general. And I will tell you that I was, people would tell you that I was outgoing and gregarious and an extrovert, okay? I didn't know how shy I was till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I dropped that facade I had, and I'm terrified to be in a room of people, except in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was thinking down here, because for some reason that lack of safety I felt as a child has been coming back. I know what it was. I went on Facebook, and I found a few people from my high school graduating class, which was only a class of 100. But it brought back feelings that I had in high school. And so I was thinking about that underlying fear that I carried with me. And I thought, you know what? The place I am safest is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in this home group. And when I arrived in Georgia, I had been going through, you know, I can't remember who said it. It might have been C.S. Lewis or somebody. But I remember reading about the dark nights of the soul. And I had been in a place like that for a couple of years in my sobriety. And I was having a hard time verbalizing it. A, I wasn't supposed to feel like that with 15 years of sobriety. B, I don't want you to know I feel like that because you might ask me to do something. And I didn't want to work anymore. Don't you understand? I have arrived. Okay. And see, I really had been so disconnected from people because we had been moving around a lot that I didn't have a safe person to talk to. I mean, it's real hard to bear your soul on the phone to somebody far away. And I walked into these rooms. This room. Oh, I remember Bill dropped me off outside. And we drove in. And I came from suburbia, okay? I drove in, and there are people out there smoking cigarettes, and it's a big old warehouse, and I'm going, okay, you know, I've always been safe in an AA meeting. I'm not going to judge this. And Bill said, I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving you here. And he said, I'll be out here, and you go in and check it out, and then you come running out if you need me. And, you know, it was great because I walked in, and I knew where I belonged. You know what I mean? But it was that initial, it's different. But it's not different. If the big book's here, if the 12 and 12's here, if sobriety's here, it's where I belong. And so I went out and I waved him off, and he said, are you sure? Are you sure? You know, it was real cute. And now he's here, supporting me. How does it work? Just fine. I remember hearing that, you know, because I had question after question on everything. And she said, don't think. Do not think. Think does not apply to you. Because I had an answer for anything she said. I had a yeah, but. Okay, yeah, but. And people that see me on a regular basis have heard some of my comments. And one of the great things she would do to me is I was like 6 or 7 years sober, and Bill wasn't changing. Okay, I mean, don't you understand how hard I'm working and how wonderful I've become? And so he just wasn't changing. He was the same. Now, granted, when he walked in that doorway that night at that party, he was perfect. That's it. Got him. You know, and for some reason, that didn't stay in here. And so I would call Beth in the morning, because I called her every morning or every other morning like I was supposed to, and I would say, good morning, blah, how are you, da, 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 because I'm so nice. I got to see how she is first. Well, I'm ready to spew my venom, and I would go, Bill, blah, and she'd go, leave him alone. You know, not, oh, poor you, not here's your solution. Her big thing was, leave him alone. And she would say it just like that. She's leading at the Marietta Roundup. Listen to her if you go, because that's what you will hear. She was just so, I told her she was militant, basically, you know, and thank God for that, because that's what I needed, you know. And today, I have a sponsor who is gentler, and that's what I need today. I'm in a different place. But getting back to that dark night of the soul, I was so stuck 4 years ago. And I was terrified. I didn't want to drink, but I was back to that feeling of I'm not. It wasn't that I didn't want to live, because I don't remember being really suicidal when I, at the end of my drinking, but the despair. You know, I was lonely, I was tired, and I was scared. I was scared to death. And I came into this room, and I sat and I listened to wonderful people who told me that God is or he isn't, that God is everything or he is nothing. I went through 14, 15, 16, 17, almost 18 years of sobriety, hanging on to a God that I wished was everything, going to a higher power that I hoped could help me, okay? And it still kept that rot gut fear in, you know, that deep dark hole in here. And, you know, I have been told that God isn't trying to get in. God's trying to get out. And it tells us in the big book that there's a God in all of us. You know, we are born with this God consciousness, this knowing. And we covered up with all the garbage of life. And that I needed to let go of some of that stuff and let my God out. Take the basket off the light, off the candle, whatever. And I wrote it down in my bid book. It was January of 2008 that I came to believe. I had known, and I had known, and I had known. But I've heard it, the longest trip in recovery is from here to here. And it went from here to here. And a peace and a joy has come over me that I would see in other people, okay? And I can remember, you know, people say, oh, you've got, you know, why are you still going to mean something? Because I go, I want what they have. I want what they have. I see it in people with 3 years sober because they've made a journey that it took me 18 years to make. I want what you have, and I want to do what you do. And my reading this morning, I have a woman's meditation book, and the little prayer at the end said, when I give, I receive. Standing here, this woman that came into these rooms so full of guilt and fear and remorse and shame. I was so ashamed of the things I did when I drank. And, you know, I didn't rob a bank, and I didn't, as I, you know, according to my children, because I hope I didn't beat the children. You know, there was no deviant behavior in our home. The emotional neglect and the inability to be the person at that time my God intended me to be was rotting my inner core. Today, with the God of my understanding present in my life, I can heal. I can continue to heal. I can give and I can receive. And you don't know what standing here in front of you people that I see every day and being able to tell it like it was and know that it's okay what you give back to me. I still need that reflected feeling, you know. I'm not well yet. I'm getting better. And I've always been one that, you know, that, I don't know what codependency, whatever jargon you want to give it. I get real tired, psychobabble sometimes. But, you know, whatever is you give me, I need to nurture me. No man is an island. And holy cow, left to my own devices, I will be as nuts today as I was 20 and a half years ago or before. So I need you to be me, so I can be the me that my God intended me to be. Thank you very much for asking me to lead your anniversary. I'm honored.